From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're joined by slide guitar virtuoso, uber sessioneer, and world music diplomat, Ry Cooder. Ryland Peter Cooder first picked up a guitar at the age of four when he lost an eye and maybe needed a new friend. He found it, and so did the guitar and a world of musicians, from the recording studios of L.A. to West Africa, India, and Havana. By the time he was 19, Ry Cooder was a studio star, bringing his irresistible slide guitar to groups from Taj Mahal and Captain Beefheart to Little Feat and the Rolling Stones. Going solo in the early 70s, Ry Cooder became a distinctive musical pilgrim, bringing his swing and syncopation, warmth and emotional depth first to American roots, Civil War tunes, Dust Bowl songs, R&B, Tex-Mex and Hawaiian, and then to the world, playing with talents like V.M. Bhatt, Ali Farka Touré, and then with the Cuban sensation, the Buena Vista Social Club, and the most successful world music CD in history. Although first fined by the U.S. State Department, Cooder was allowed one more visit to musical, mystical Cuba. The result is his latest CD that we're listening to right now, Mambo Sinuendo, in which Ry Cooder has paired his guitar with that of Cuban guitar maestro Manuel Galban, who Ry Cooder describes as the last man twanging in Havana. Tonight, Ry Cooder, an American master who has searched the world for honest music, music with authenticity. Ry Cooder, it's an honor to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks. That's a hell of an introduction there.
Well, my friend, if you only knew, I could go on and I could go on. But you have been stuck in this one American music listening mind for a long, long, long time. And I have a great debt of gratitude to you for many years of music that was somehow had all the energy that was missing in so much of the pop music out there. And I find myself wondering over these years, Ry Cooder, as you've gone through that, all these American genres and out into the world, if you felt yourself as a pilgrim, as a searcher for something, what was it?
Well, it's a good question, I guess. When you're doing it, you don't look upon it, though, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. One doesn't say, I see myself as a searcher or a pilgrim, of course, you know, naturally. It's probably the most clearest thought I might have ever had was, I'm trying to learn to play guitar, and I'm trying to learn how to access, to use a kind of a fancy word, you know, certain emotions or certain experiences through the instrument, because it's the vehicle for seeing and the vehicle for awareness that I had in my hands. In other words, I wasn't a writer, I wasn't a painter, I wasn't a philosopher or whatever, you know. I didn't quite develop along those lines. A mathematician, perhaps, you know.
Yep.
So the instrument was like a surfboard or something. Call it magic carpet, if you like. I don't know.
I would. But, in your hands, I would.
Yeah, so when I was pretty young, I guess a teenage, right before around those session times, but I could see that there was, records were proof that there was a world of information that it was hard to link up to if you lived in Santa Monica and all this, and it was just tough. So you had to really push your envelope internally, I mean, you know.
Just be in suburban Santa Monica locked down.
Locked down, and as many were. In fact, everybody I knew pretty much was locked down at the time. And then I began to meet people who were floating around and doing things, and I could see that this was the answer and a good way to live, and it seems to have been true, you know.
And thank God you took the path. Ry Cooder, I've been such a fan for so long, but to tell you the truth, I really, until preparing for this show, had never looked into the kind of biographical part of your life. I've known you through your music, and your music has been more important than I can say in my life. Now, I just dip into the river of information that's out there today, and I've learned so much. I mean, starting with the story of you as a young boy in Santa Monica, and the radio as a kind of connection between that youth and the Latin music that's come to so define the last half decade or so of your life and recording.
Right. Well, fortunately, in L.A. at that time, that's the 50s, they had so many groups were emerging here. The southern people, the hillbillies, Arkies, Okies, come out to work in the defense industry, so they had radio station for them, which was my favorite. Mm. This radio station was something else. I mean, it was Western Swing. You heard Merle Travis and Bob Wills, and you could hear Hank Snow singing, you know, Yellow Roses and all this stuff. I used to always say, I'm sick, I can't go to school, my throat hurt.
And they would and say, not okay. For the top 40 where you stayed.
And they'd go off to work, my parents, and I'd lay there in bed listening to this radio station. It was an experience I wish everybody could have now, and you can't have it.
It's going away.
And there was everything's gone. The black radio station was great. Because you had Jimmy Reed in those days. You had even Howlin' Wolf on that radio station in those days.
Yeah.
Regional radio and so forth. And then there were Mexican stations, of course.
And all of that pouring into the ears of the boy in Santa Monica.
And bowling. I used to like listen to bowling, broadcast from bowling alleys.
The percussion of the falling pins?
Yeah, the space.
The ball rolling.
The echo of the pins falling down. There he goes again. And I just thought, what a deal.
There he goes again.
Where's that?
I may be overextending, but I can hear some of that echoing, I don't know, garage or bowling alley sound in some of the acoustics that you've got on your new album, Mambo Sinuendo.
Oh, sure.
Let's listen to a little something more from that. There was one cut that I really love, Bolero Sonambulo. Let's listen to Ry Cooter's new album, Mambo Sinuendo. Tell us how you chose this song.
Oh, this song, it appeared during a break. You know, this is intensive work and it's tiring. So sometimes
this is recording in Havana.
In Havana with Galban, and you might like to get up and wander around, get a cup of coffee, you know, and he goes in this case, sat down to the piano just to relax, starts playing this thing. And I watch him. I'm always watching him, you know, to make sure that I know what he's doing and I can see that he's onto something. So I ran out. Grab Keltner, we ran out, just the two extra of us, and started playing with him. You can hear Keltner playing the most eccentric drum part in the world because he knows from experience, 30 years experience with me, you don't have time to think, just react, and keep doing it. Don't stop.
It's laid back to the point of I don't know what.
Well, he's playing a part nobody would play, you know, intentionally. So then, of course, my thought is, and I know that the session dat's on, that is to say, the recording, there is some recording technology that's working, so we have this going on. It's not hitting
going,
the air.
Keep it going, right.
Yeah. Don't turn off. And then you have to hope that Galban doesn't get up from the piano because he's always wandering around. So he seemed to be into it, so we just kept playing. And then, of course, cut the tape, and there's a nice, pretty tune.
How fabulous it was. And, of course, some of our listeners may not know Manuel Galban. He was from one of Cuba's most popular groups in the 50s and just a tremendous guitar maestro there.
Yes. Well, Los Zafiros were the most well-known and loved of the sort of so-called doo-wop vocal quartets that sprang up down in Havana, of course, only in Havana, not in the countryside, the city form, you know, borrowing or importing, hybridizing, whatever, from the American vocal group sound that they must have heard on the radio. They didn't have much access to outside music in those days.
But they picked it up, and wow, did they run
they
with
sure
it.
They sure picked it up, yeah.
You, of course, went to Cuba for Buena Vista Social Club, a tremendous sensation. I hadn't known until boning up for this show that you ended up fined $100,000 for going down. Of course, that access has been difficult for many years, and ended up getting a special dispensation from Bill Clinton in one of his last days as president to go down and do this album, Mambo Sinuendo.
Yeah. This and the Ibrahim Ferrer second solo record. Well, sure, we had to do it. You had to do it. You know, it was obvious that it's a good idea, and you couldn't exactly just sit there and wait for everybody to drift off or for the moment to evaporate. You know what I mean?
Because this is music that is expiring if you don't grab it. I mean, these musicians are old.
Well, plus the consciousness of it is transpiring. Yeah. There's no more, even now, to this day, right now, this moment, I wouldn't have wanted to have to do this. We did this in 2001. I wouldn't have wanted to try it in 2002. Hip-hop has already altered the course of consciousness in Cuba quite a lot.
Right, Cooter, I want to do a tremendous backflip here. And if you'll indulge me, go back to a night in 1972. I was with some friends at a house out by Tick's Junkyard. They were a bunch of musician friends of mine. I had rented a house there, and it was a summer night. I opened the front door. I walked up on the porch and said, "You've got to listen to this." And coming off the stereo was Boomer Story, your third album, I guess.
A house in a junkyard?
Well, it was next to the junkyard fence.
That sounds good. I like that.
Oh, boy. Let's listen to just...
I like junkyard.
We can hear it in this album for sure. Let's go back. And here's where I hook in, Rye. I'm sorry. This is personal, but this goes way back with me. Let's listen to a little bit. Boomer Story from a CD of the same name from Rye Cooter, 1972.
Met a little gal in Frisco. I asked her to be my wife. I was tired of roaming, gonna settle down for life. Well, then I heard the whistle blowing, and I knew it was a red ball train. And I let that gal beside the railroad, and never saw that gal again. Boy, I never saw that gal again. Saw that gal again.
Rye Cooter, God bless your fingers and your voice and the whole thing. That album has lived with me, you know, longer than any good dog I've had. It's just...
Yeah, well, the dogs don't live that long.
No, they don't, but digital does. Here you'd been with Taj Mahal, Captain Beefheart, the Stones, and Little Feat. But what plugged you back in to American, I don't know, you describe it, roots, Dust Bowl, hillbilly, railroad, hobo, folk?
Pop folk, in a way. We think of folk music as written by, you know, rustic type people, but invariably they're very clever and they're talented.
Sure.
And they may be part of a local musical environment, but in every case, this song is a perfect example of somebody who's able to take a very wide, vague experience and put it down to maybe three verses, and you have got the whole hobo thing, the wobbly thing, the IWW thing. And
listen to a Boomer Story. Pay attention to what I say.
Boomers, they were the guys who were thrown off the railroad payroll for asking for more money or wanting to organize. So there's a populistic trend in all these things. But these were not just simple-minded cats. I mean, I learned this song from a Cisco Houston record. God knows where he ever heard it, because he was right at the edge of where he would have heard it on the street, if you see what I'm saying.
I do. And when you listen back now, I mean, we're getting on 30 years later. Mm-hmm. What do you hear in that young voice, in that young impulse of Rye Cooter picking this song up and singing it?
Well, I hear Jim Dickinson on piano being my good friend and the guy who was able to just, you know, go on an instrument where I was trying to go. I mean,
we
didn't know too many people in those days who even wanted to bother. Most folks were trying to make money or get started in folk rock and be slick and be effective on that level, and I didn't quite know how to do that, but I figured I knew how to do this. It never dawned on me how hard it was going to be to reach the public, though, let me just tell you. In your case, that's one thing, but in most cases, nobody batted an eye, really.
Well, you reached me, brother. We'll come back and talk about that struggle with the whole pop music world. We're talking tonight with slide guitar virtuoso, world music ambassador, my personal musical hero, Rye Cooter. This is On Point. Here's Secret Love from his new album, Mambo Sinuendo. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with slide guitar virtuoso and global pilgrim for musical authenticity, Ry Cooder. Here's early Ry Cooder, Married Man's a Fool, from his 1974 album Paradise and Lunch.
Had a friend, Louis Brown. He was a deacon, just as wise as he could be. Now you realize he could read the cookbook back from Revelation down to Genesee. You know, last Sunday morning, he was over to the church. My buddy wants to take a Mustang. And he looks out upon the whole congregation, the good book in his hand. Now he cast his eye about. And then he looks over in the amen corner. All the sisters come at the shout.
What'd he say?
He said, a married man's a fool. Think that his wife loves nobody else but him.
Married Man's a Fool, from Ry Cooder's Paradise and Lunch. Ry Cooder, through your entire recording career, I have loved and laughed at the humor in your songs, and it seems to me somehow fundamentally connected to this swingy, syncopation, twangy, slangy thing that's running around in all of your music. Do you have as much fun as it sounds like?
Well, look, it's very hard to make these things work. We worked on Married Man's a Fool for days because there's breaks, there's 6/4 bars, all the breaks that make it interesting so that you can introduce the speaking part. And, man, that was not easy in those days to do because we weren't really used to it. Nobody did this. All these guys, even Keltner, did other kinds of work daily. Rock and roll is not like this at all.
So when I would find
these guys, they'd be coming off other sessions or they'd be coming off other things, and I would have to, like, decompress them a little and make this happen because I had to insist on it. Playing the backwards beats, you know?
Yeah, and it makes
not
it
easy.
Not easy at all. Out of step with what we were hearing on the radio at that time. I mean, Revelations down to Genesee and everything
that gives you
the platform to say that. gosh, it's fabulous. But I can't help but feel the link between the slide itself and the attitude of the song. Maybe the slide makes the attitude. How did slide guitar become the Ry Cooder hallmark?
Well, I don't know, but you see, in those days, frankly, it was not too common, you know. To play it at all was a bit obscure, and then to play it on the electric guitar in an ensemble with drums and bass was not being done. Of course, Howlin' Wolf and Elmore James were doing fine with it, and artistic and everything, but this is a slightly different effort. So what I learned from the early sessions was do something that is not usual or typical in the middle of these sessions, and you will... Not only will you stand apart a bit, and it will help color the thing or make it interesting. So that's the same theory I had. But, you know, to take a Blind Willie McTell song like this and straighten it out and teach it to this group, man, it's a piece of work. But it is funny and good. It's a great song.
Oh,
anyway.
It's just fabulous. We know you did
a lot of hysterical.
So many of your songs, particularly on this album, Paradise and Lunch, just leave me laughing every time, year after year. We know you did a lot of teaching one way and another. Keith Richards quoted in the Washington Post saying, I took Ry Cooder for everything I could get on the slide front. And, of course, your slide on Little Feat's Willin', and in many, many places I found myself over the years, I'd be at a film. You did a lot of soundtrack work. I found myself at a film where I didn't know you were in there, and suddenly, my gosh, that's got to be Ry Cooder. And, of course, sure enough, it was in Paris, Texas, and others. But the dance with the popular music realm was never an easy one for you, and I wonder if you can describe what your initial ambitions were in that regard and how they evolved as you found that this wasn't going to be a mainline connection for you.
Well, you have to realize, though, in this day and age of sophistication and information, I can't stress strongly enough how ignorant I was of the business. I didn't understand it. When I started, I didn't understand how microphones work, how tape machines work, let alone the business that was attached to it. In other words, the money and the minds of the record people and the minds of marketing and radio. Mm. Man, let me tell you, I did not know what it was. My idea was make these records. I like it. Other people will like it. Totally wrong. Nobody hires you to think that way. So then it dawned on me after a while that these Warner Brothers guys, they were tolerant of me, of course, but I wasn't really a player for them. I wasn't on the team. And I kept not being on the team. And, in fact, it got worse. When I got together with Flaco Jimenez on accordion, the Tex-Mex guys that I got, you know, interested in, That was it. Somebody said professional suicide. In fact, it was Randy Newman who said, you're committing professional suicide here.
Did Warner Brothers try and get a bit in your teeth? Did they sit you down and say, Rye, you could have a great career, but you've to shape up? What was their advice? What did they want you to do?
Well, they wanted me to play heroic rock and roll electric guitar. That's what they looked at me and saw, and it didn't dawn on me, and I didn't quite know that that's what the role was or the job was asking for. I didn't know that, really. Because I said, man, I'm doing the best I can. What's wrong with you guys? But that was...
But everybody else in America knew it at that time, right? I'm so glad you didn't make that choice. But come on. I mean, look, that's what guitar kids wanted to be, wasn't it?
No,
what made
no,
you people, different, Mr. Cooter?
No. Everybody said, if you have a shot in the business, which is rare and hard to get there, you go for the program and do it. And what else would you do and why else would you? You know, in other words, get the sign here, kid, get your Cadillac.
Well, that's
what's wrong
mean.
With that?
Didn't most people want to do that heroic rock guitar?
That's
what I'm saying.
Yes,
so,
of course.
So what was that strange bean behind your ear that kept you off in a different direction?
Well, I just kept hearing something in my head, you know, that there was music that could be done hybrid, if you like to call it, some kind of recreation or participation in another form. And I also think I was very fond of these older forms just because it felt good to me. I liked it so much. You know, all these tunes, I just loved them so much. I didn't see anything wrong, but no, sir, you're supposed to write songs about yourself and you're supposed to be sad and have high cheekbones and all that. But not everybody can do that. You only can go what your nature is telling you to do, and I guess that's what I sort of did. And Terry Melcher, the famous producer who started me off in session work, you know, when I started making these records, I was 23 years old, and he shook his head and said, because he was a guy for the radio and a guy for the top 10, and he says, this is going to take you a long time.
It's a long way up the mountain, Rye Cooter.
Yeah, he says, it's going to take you minimum 20 years to get around with this kind of an approach. I said, oh, no, you know, that's not true. That can't be true. Of course, he was right. Righter than he knew, you know.
Righter than he knew. You nosedatted a bit, though. I mean, you kept your sail out where it might have caught that popular wind. In your album, Borderline, a number of songs that could play in that realm, one that I just love, Why Don't You Try Me? Let's listen from Rye Cooter's Borderline.
If your man's got you on the run, why don't you try me? If you want to have a little fun, oh baby, why don't you try me? If you talk more than you can bear, if your trouble's been more than your share, and if things are not going just right, why don't you try a man like me tonight? Hey, baby, why don't you try me tonight? Why don't you try me?
A great song, man.
Great song, a great song. God, who sang that song? Who played that? You had to write extra words. Tell me.
Well, sure. The whole story about last night while I was trying to sleep, I heard a racket in the room next door. You know, women used to come up after the shows because this song and performance was awesome.
Right.
That's not fair, they would say. That's not fair. I don't like that.
Why?
Oh, people are so literal-minded, you see. And I began to notice this literalness, this kind of over... attention to, they think everything is real, like TV has taught people to think, you know?
Right. If it's in the lyric, it's real.
Yeah, but I always figured the more exotic, the better, you know? In other words, what I liked about old movies, they're completely unreal. Isn't that much better
than out there.
Having your reality thrown back in your face all the time?
Right.
What a drag.
Right. So what was it that they thought you were soliciting with this lyric, or what was it
no,
that they
were thought I was.
To?
They thought I wasn't being very nice to... They must have thought there was a complaint also about the chicken skin music cover that was misogynist or it was
the skeleton
that weren't right.
Mexican iconography, the skeleton's kind of getting it on with the voluptuous, but it's cartoon and it's right out of Mexican art.
Said.
I mean, the skeleton is everywhere.
Right, what's wrong with that? And as I say, what's wrong with something different? I mean, can't you dig it if it's something, but you know, a lot of people with the politically correct notion, and I can understand that, you know, but they don't understand the black experience. I'm not saying I'm expert in it, but if the blues isn't funny, I'd like to know what is.
I'd like to know, too.
Going that's right back to the beginning of it.
Deep down funny at the bone. I don't know. Why don't you try me tonight? Sounds like just about the, it's probably the first word spoken by Homo sapiens right there.
That's a very funny song.
A great song. But it wasn't long after this album that Ry Cooder, we can see it and feel it in your recording and your lack of recording, you began to turn your back on the whole pop idea, it seems to me. Was that deliberate, or were you frozen out, or what happened there?
I think you feel, if you don't feel a context for yourself, then it's very hard. In other words, where do I don't fit in. I always wanted to be part of something. First, I wanted to be part of a honky-tonk white redneck group. That didn't happen. Then I wanted to be part of a rhythm and blues gospel group. That didn't happen. Then I wanted to be on a Tex-Mex band, and I forced that to happen, but it really didn't happen, if you see what I mean. It wasn't until Havana that I found there was actually a world that you could comfortably and be welcomed into and be, you know, happy in. Do you see what I'm saying? The thing is, in the pop scene as it developed, let's say in the 70s and certainly in the 80s, I didn't see where I was going to fit in at all. And there was no more context. The radio and the way records were being made and the sound of the records, even the sound of guitars and drums. I just didn't feel at home in this. And so I thought the Tex-Mex thing got me started on the possibility of, you know, first of all, the Latin, because the Latin is so swinging, you know, and in Spanish, you can say anything. And it's very poetic and beautiful. And the accordions is. And the rhythms and the cumbias and the rancheras. And it's still listen to that stuff every day.
Yeah.
But just a lot happier way to live, I think.
You know, it's a great moment in a person's life. And thank the Lord that you found it in yours, where you just gave up on that mainstream thing and turned off in a different direction. That Latin music and the rest were there to catch. I mean, it's a great gift. Sorry, Rife, they didn't all sell a million copies, but...
Well, you have to resign yourself. I mean, I didn't...
It's the real thing.
Okay.
Yes, you've been doing just fine, I'd say. We've got a little lick here of something you did with V.M. Bhatt called The Ganges Blues. Tell us about this before we get to it. As I understand, you made this recording in 2 hours.
Well, something like 2 hours.
Something like that. And he plays something unusual. It's a kind of a vina, but not really?
Mm-hmm. It's a vina that he sort of converted. It's a slide idea, like a dobro, but vina is that. That's
Vina's
what vina
very close
is.
To slide guitar, right?
Sure, it's the beginning of it, I suppose.
In the Indian musical sector.
And he's very, you know, good, and he trained with Ravi Shankar for 30 years, like these guys have to do, and he can play ragas in 70-minute northern Indian classical music. It's light years beyond me. Easily, you can hear him. He's just got it, you know.
And once
but
again,
this record was supposed to be something a little more approachable. And I told him straight out, man, when we met and sat down to do this, I says, you know, now I'm not one of these guys. I can't do that kind of music. So he says, well, we will play something very simple and it will be okay, you know. But he got bored. After 2 hours of doing this kind of stuff, he just didn't want to do it anymore. He wanted to go and wig out and do his great big thing.
His traditional thing.
I got up and went to the hotel.
Well, I'm glad you had those 2 hours. And once again, for me, you were the good ghost sitting on my shoulder. I spent a lot of time in India. I turn around and here you are with V.M. Bhatt. Let's listen to a little bit of Ganges Blues. Ganges Blues from A Meeting by the River, Ry Cooder and V.M. Bhatt. Ry, there of course is Indian music with centuries, millennia of history, and you coming in kind of off the American route with your slide guitar. Was it an easy meeting? V.M. Bhatt may have wanted to get back to his tradition. How did it feel from the American side of the equation?
Well, it was a thing that my good friend Kavi Alexander, who has Water Lily Acoustics, the label, and we recorded this with him, and he was insistent. I mean, I says, Kavi, I cannot play that music. Now, you know that I can't. He says, no, you'll be fine. Just sit there and play little things with him and just please do this. And I says, oh, well, all right, for you, as a favor, I'll do it. And then at the end of the 2 hours, I says, man, Kavi, I'm sorry, but I don't know if you have anything here. This feels a little strange. I don't know if we really got anywhere. You can't expect to meet people on the fly and just fall into this like East meets West is usually a kind of a problem.
Calamity.
A train wreck.
Can be.
But Kavi says, I think this is going to be real nice. And then he put it out. He cut the tape and he put it out and people liked it. What can I say? It sure surprised me.
It's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. Right, the Washington Post, when they wrote up your newest album, Mumble Sinuendo, opens their story with you describing how you originally got into the guitar, that you had an accident mm-hmm. as a very young boy mm-hmm. at four, lost an eye, and a neighbor came by. And tell us the story. What had happened? Was this a kind of savior thing for you?
Well, who can put a word to it? I mean, this man, Leo Brager, was not just a neighbor. He was a concert violinist, like with the L.A. Philharmonic or something, who had been blacklisted in the McCarthy time, very seriously blacklisted, and couldn't work anymore. And, you know, musicians who were caught in that snare mm-hmm. couldn't get out mm-hmm. because music studios and organizations like the L.A. Philharmonic, incredibly conservative mm-hmm. and beholden to politics, you know, and, sure. and the way the wind was blowing. And so this guy was out. So he did things like camp counseling and whatever he could. But he brought this tenor guitar over, and I had any idea what it was. I mean, what's that? He goes.
And you were still in bed recuperating.
Well, I was lying down. It was night, and mm-hmm. he brought this thing in the dark, and he sets this thing down on my stomach as I'm lying in bed, and he strums the strings and said, "It's a guitar, and boy, you feel this resonance, and it's little, and you can handle this."
Yeah.
And so, of course, I liked music. I had records, and my parents had classical music on all the time, and it was not like bringing me a... something alien, you know, but like
organic for you.
Yeah, it wasn't like bringing me a power drill or something I didn't know understand,
right,
but
right.
I could understand it. See, my dad could play it, and so he showed me how to chord and get around. And then it wasn't too long after that I began to pay attention to sort of guitar music, as you might at that young age, mm-hmm. and, you know, the occasional 78 album of flamenco or whatever. But, you know, it's what happens when somebody opens a door. And it just happens to be the right door, because there's a lot of doors you might go through, especially
sure
when you're young and growing up. You know, you could try different things, and that's part of growing up.
You became such a virtuoso. Can you still remember the weight, the feeling of that first guitar on your four-year-old chest?
Well, sure, I can certainly remember it. I still have it as far as that goes. I've kept it, you know. But when something feels comfortable or that you know you can do it and you're young, then you'll just keep doing it, see? I wasn't very good at baseball, but I knew I could do this. And the older I got, the more convinced I was that this was something that I knew there was a reason to do it and there was some kind of future in it, although who knew what, you know.
That guitar has stayed a pretty good friend in guitars mm-hmm. right on through.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Ry Cooter, slide guitar virtuoso, musical master on so many fronts. My personal music hero. Let's go into a break with Mambo Sinuendo, title track from Ry Cooter's new album. Here he is with Manuel Galban, Mambo Sinuendo. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Ry Cooter, slide guitar master and keeper of a great musical heart and soul. From his groundbreaking CD, Buena Vista Social Club, this is Chan Chan. Chan Chan from the CD Buena Vista Social Club, Ry Cooter's great march into the arms of Cuban music. Ry Cooter, this album made such a splash, and of course the movie that came out by the same name really took people into Havana, many people, for the first time in many, many years. What a scene. You were first there way back in the 70s with American Jazzmen. Tell us about that first trip.
Well, they the cruise ship line people who were plying the Caribbean, so to speak, wanted to start going to Havana, including it as a stop along the way. They thought it'd be a good idea. So the Cubans said, okay, you can come with your boat, you know, but you're going to have to bring us something, so bring us jazz musicians. It seemed like a pretty good idea, and I heard about this. None other than Dizzy Gillespie and his band, Earl Hines and his band, and Stan Getz. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, this is going to be something else. So my wife and I just raised my hand and said, I'm a guitar player. Let me come. I'll just hold the door open for these fellas.
It was 1976 or so.
Yeah. And that's kind of what we did. And we went down there and spent a couple of days wandering around in Havana. And it was amazing. And gave a big concert with all these guys. I mean, it was incredible to see it. And just to talk to people, and at one point we were walking through this park in the middle of town, grassy park, nice, and here was this old guy in the over under a tree with a couple of players doing this sewn thing. Turned out it was Nico Sacchito, you know, 10,000 years old.
Yeah.
And Susie says, come over, these are the guys you're looking for. I said, ah, this is the thing. Now I have found it, Nirvana is here. So after spending a couple of days, I had ideas in my mind that this was the ideal music. The place was great. We would move here, stay for 2 years. I would find some way to live and just be around such people, because this was no longer possible in the United States.
Paradise.
And certainly, you know, an unbelievable opportunity. But right soon after, we went home, and right soon after, our son Joaquin was born, and then that changed a lot of things, and I ended up doing other things and getting busy. And I always used to think, oh, I'm missing this opportunity 100%. I mean, these people are going to die and so forth, you know, and I'll never get back down and it'll be too late. And, you know, one is plagued by these notions
but of course, all the time. But of course,
you worry about such things.
You know? And rightly, because these are perishable, but you did get back. Buena Vista Social Club was so big. And then the new album. Let's hear another cut from Mambo Sinuendo, La Luna en Tu Mirada. Describe what you are kind of reviving and extending here, what musical tradition or moment.
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's probably fair to say, though, that it's a combination of things. One being a time when music was ambient and environmental and atmospheric, and that was true right up until, I think, the Beatles. And by that I mean, I should be saying, recorded music.
Yes.
Reflecting, let's say, a place, reflecting a way of life, reflecting even the way people listen and think. I mean, then, in a very funny, subtle way, taking the Beatles as a perfect example of this, when you change the technology somewhat, and you change the sound somewhat, and you change the dollar amount that's attached to it somewhat, and you change the way it looks, and you convert this whole idea of personal expression and inward-looking expression,
yes,
which had been in a sort of an interesting way linked with commerce, you see. Of course, everything has to be linked with commerce, and therefore, otherwise, it wouldn't exist.
But also linked with real soul.
Yeah, but it's a balance, you know what I'm saying? The hardware, the money, the way of life, all in balance.
Yeah.
But then, post-Beatles, we see something quite different emerging, and that's, you know, the enlargement of the commercial idea, the complication of the hardware idea, and the stylizing of everything
until
from the outside.
So until it squeezes out what?
Well, the inner voice, I think, of it is being the person who says, like Ibrahim Ferrer says or thinks, I sound this way, I sing this way, that's who I am, period. And you want me to sing, I'll sing. And you don't want me to sing, I won't sing. But when I do sing, it will reflect only this. There's very little else he can do or would do.
Because
the same is true of Howlin' Wolf, or the same is true of Elvis Presley, as far as that goes, up to a point. Of course,
and I would say,
Elvis drifted off, and poor man, you know.
Yeah.
But that's what this music on record means to me. It's trying to reassert this. I think it's valid. I think it's worthwhile. And I think it's nice for people
who are routinely
being shortchanged and underestimated and beaten up every damn day of their lives, I have to say, by media and by commerce, and to the point where their only clue as to who they might be that they find in a sitcom on the goddamn television. And I don't support that, and I protest against it, and I don't like it.
And I stand right next to you, Ry Cooter, and I'm so grateful to you for holding it up all these years. You know, when I sat down and listened with that last tune, La Luna en tu Mirada, I couldn't help hear a kind of slower, more mature, a little bit sadder and wiser version of a song that I loved way back from my first Ry Cooter on Boomer Story. This, what we're hearing coming up behind us here, Maria Elena. Always that beautiful, deep, soulful guitar. Ry Cooter, I cannot express my gratitude to you enough for the pilgrim you've been and the way you've let people like me come along for the ride. It has been absolutely fabulous. I wish you many, many more years of doing it, and I'm just deeply, deeply grateful to you for all your music and for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks so much. That's nice to hear.
Ry Cooter, we'll go out listening to Maria Elena from Boomer Story. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
It was a parked car. Suddenly, there was a big bang. You could hear it a long way away, and it must have killed lots of people.
Mr. Blair told the judicial inquiry that if it could be shown that material had been inserted into the dossier at the behest of his office, as alleged in a BBC News report, it would have merited his resignation.
The Prime Minister asked me to stay on because the Iraq issue was at that point developing in a particularly alarming way. But we agreed back in April that I would definitely go this summer.
It's a different NASA today than it was on February the 1st. Our lives are forever changed by this tragic event, but nowhere near as much of the lives of the survivors of the Columbia crew.
We're right in near downtown Los Angeles. Mars is so bright that that doesn't make any difference. Really, thousands of people, it's just a sea of people. It's incredible. So many people want to see Mars.
We have a number of studies that we've put in our rulemaking record to show that we don't think this will have an appreciable emissions impact one way or the other.
It's analogous to saying that you can replace the engine in your Honda with a super-polluting Hummer engine and that therefore you don't have to do anything about the pollution increase that results.
We say, Mr. Pryor, honor God's law!
I believe that it is appropriate to display the Ten Commandments in a courthouse, but I have an obligation to uphold and enforce the law, even when I disagree with it. A court has ruled, and I'm going to go about doing my duties.
Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty, we are free at last!
We owe it to that leadership that came before us to come out and pay respect.
Being black and born in Georgia, it means a whole lot to me to see all of us together.
Bremer tells the Washington Post that it's almost impossible to exaggerate how much money Iraq will need. And he says the U.S. hopes to get the billions necessary from other countries and U.S. taxpayers.
The basic CBO projections are for a deficit in fiscal year 2003 of $401 billion, in fiscal year 2004, a peak of $480 billion.
With this arrest, we want to deliver a message to cyber hackers here and around the world. We will devote all available resources to tracking down those who attack our technological infrastructure.
They're in complete disbelief that the Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Hakim has been assassinated 40 minutes after the explosion happened. It was pure chaos.
And there is a week. Two car bombs kill at least 52 and injure more than 150 in the Indian financial capital of Mumbai, Bombay. British Prime Minister Tony Blair testifies before the Hutton inquiry. Blair's Director of Communications, Alistair Campbell, resigned today. NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe reacts to the release of the Columbia Shuttle disaster report. People around the world gather to view Mars at its closest point to Earth in 60,000 years. The EPA announces it will relax pollution control requirements on older power plants. The Ten Commandments are removed from the state Supreme Courthouse in Montgomery, Alabama. The nation observed the 40th anniversary of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. American occupation head Paul Bremer says it will cost tens of billions of dollars more to rebuild Iraq. Director of the Congressional Budget Office projects a supersized U.S. budget deficit. 18-year-old Jeffrey Lee Parson is arrested in Minneapolis and charged with spreading the blaster worm over the Internet. And a car bomb kills top Iraqi Shiite leader Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Hakim in Najaf today, along with at least 75 more. Jack Beatty, August is going out with a bang this week.
It's really been the cruelest month, hasn't it? Mm. The war after the war continues to go calamitously. 282 dead Americans so far, something like 7,000 dead Iraqi civilians. The enemy has struck at all the vulnerable places, you know, the Jordanian embassy, the UN headquarters, the holiest site of Shia, as if going after all the joins that connect different important places and countries with Iraq. One can almost predict that there's going to be some kind of Kurdish outrage to come.
I can just imagine what it's like to be an American soldier there, hunkered down. Threats everywhere, hot as Hades. I mean, God bless those guys and women.
Yes, and their leaders, Secretary Rumsfeld and then President Bush really gave an extraordinary rationale this week for what's happening there, or an explanation, rather. Rumsfeld allowed us how we are, by being in one place, we are drawing the terrorists to us, and this is good because we can destroy them that way. Well, of course, that assumes that there's a finite amount of terrorists. It assumes that our flesh and blood should stand up under a war of attrition. It assumes that there's no end to this if the other two assumptions are wrong. I was really shocked by that.
And at the very least, it's obvious this is not fish in a barrel. This is a very dynamic situation. So is the political situation at home. President Bush's poll numbers not as strong this week, Jack.
No, I've seen some that have him 52, 53, right in there. And also the extraordinary rise this week of Howard Dean, 21 points ahead of John Kerry in New Hampshire and slightly ahead of Dick Gephardt in Iowa. And, of course, Dick Gephardt has been wearing Iowa for the past decade.
And General Wesley Clark in the wings here.
He's in the wings, according to, I think, the president of the University of Iowa. He's giving a speech there on the 19th and will announce his candidacy then. And it's shaping up as a battle of the anti-war candidates, in that case, Clark and Dean.
Suddenly, there's an awful lot to talk about in this looming campaign season. It could be a really defining season. You know, Jack, with all this happening this week, though, I love the sight of so many people out staring up at Mars, just the fascination with the universe out there and how close it comes to us sometimes. Fantastic. Jack, have a great Labor Day weekend.
And you too. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.